So good evening. Welcome to tonight, to the 583 participants that we've got here tonight, for tonight's webinar on a patient-centred approach to achieving better outcomes for people living with schizophrenia and the viewers who are watching on the podcast. So the Mental Health Practitioner Network would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land, seas and waterways across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay our respects to the elders, past, present and future, for the memories, traditions, the cultures and hopes of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians. So hi, I'm Julianne White and I'm facilitating tonight's session. So just a little bit about myself, I won't take very long, so I'll just scroll down my screen. I'm an accredited mental health social worker, having graduated in 2003 with a Master's in Social Work. And this is after 30 years as a registered nurse in a variety of health settings. And I founded the Amaranth Foundation in 2009, and with my amazing team of counsellors, support workers, nurses, mental health nurses and mental health social workers, we provide a range of supports and therapeutic services across southern New South Wales and northeast Victoria. And I'm thrilled to be your facilitator this evening. It's a discussion that is very much needed and very dear to my heart. So understanding the lived experience of people with schizophrenia and hearing from a range of speakers here tonight, as well as having an opportunity to participate in this interactive question and answer session, will hopefully reinforce your already existing skills or provide you with information and resources to be able to venture tentatively and gently into this space, and that is working alongside people with schizophrenia. So tonight I want to introduce you to our panellists. Here we've got Russell. So Russell is a lived experience and an advocate for schizophrenia. Now, what I'm going to do is ask each one of these people an introductory question before I go on to the next one. So Russell, in your bio, you mentioned that you are always on a constant pathway to recovery. Can you please tell us and everyone here tonight, what is one of your recovery highlights?
Early days, volunteer work was important in terms of the value of not only a voluntary hospitalisation and the admission, but also the value intrinsic in giving to others rather than being a taker. So for me, I believe in a philosophy of being good to others, and that's helpful in terms of the values and the skills that I've learnt through the voluntary work that I've done. And I carry that through and onwards and upwards in trying always to do those little things that people remember, or helping a lady cross the road, or helping a mother with her shopping when she's got a handful of kids and shopping and all that sort of thing. So just the little things that you can do, to me, it's about making a difference. And my, I guess, motivation is about making a difference as well.
Yeah.
So little things that I can do that I can contribute to.
That is really beautiful, Russell. Thank you for that. That's really lovely, and I think that's really important for us to remember as clinicians that it's often the little things that really do matter. Now over to Dr. Kathy Andronis from Victoria. She's a general practitioner. So welcome, Kathy. Now your introductory question is, for your patients living with schizophrenia, what are some of the benefits of having a stable relationship with their general practitioner?
Well, having a stable relationship with a GP is usually the best way to get the best outcome, really. So good engagement with the usual GP on a regular basis is really important for getting best outcomes, getting to understand that person, knowing their supports, understanding their families, and most importantly, to be holistic and to treat the patient, not the disease. So a good relationship with a GP can hopefully achieve that.
I've got a follow-up question for you in the Q&A about that, but thank you so much, Kathy. That's lovely. And now we go to Melissa. Dr. Melissa Connell is a psychologist from Queensland. Welcome, Melissa. Now, Melissa, I've got an introductory question for you. And I note in your bio, which is really lovely to read, that you work with the Australian Psychological Society's Psychosis and Psychology Interest Group and the Australian branch of the International Society for Psychological and Social Approaches to Psychosis, or the ISPS. Could you please explain, I've never heard of these amazing groups, could you please say, what do you do in these groups, Melissa? Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, thanks. Well, we know that people who have a diagnosis of schizophrenia often struggle with the way this is seen through a biomedical framework. And medication is often the mainstay and sometimes the only form of treatment. And unfortunately, medications also have a lot of significant side effects and adverse health outcomes. So psychological approaches can really play an important role in treatment. And they're not often recommended to people who may struggle with psychosis-related difficulties. Mm-hmm. So the organisations that I'm involved in are really trying to promote psychological approaches to understanding and supporting people with psychosis-related problems.
Oh, wonderful. Look, thank you, Melissa. I think that's great, and I'm sure you're going to explain more about all of that in your presentation too, aren't you? Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. And now we go to Dr. Richard Lakeman, who's a mental health nurse from Queensland. Welcome, Richard. And Richard, your introductory question is, what is it that you find rewarding about working with people with schizophrenia?
I'm privileged to have trained as a nurse and a psychotherapist, and one of, I guess, the unique experiences that we have is spending prolonged periods of time over long periods with people in extreme states. So that affords the opportunity to really understand or attempt to understand their experience, and I find that enormously rewarding, the different perspectives, the understanding that can arise and that kind of relationship over a period of time. And I guess also in relation to what Melissa was talking about in terms of psychological strategies, being able to adapt and apply those strategies in the context of that kind of different kind of relationship, not quite psychotherapy, not a 50-minute hour, but, walking alongside people. And then seeing the rewards from that, the personal and functional recovery that generally ensues.
Oh, Richard, that's a really person-centred approach, isn't it? I really love that when you really appreciate that experience with people and the positive outcomes, so thank you for that. So thank you to all our panellists tonight. That was really excellent. I really know we're going to have a fabulous evening, so I hope my nerves don't get in the way for tonight, being my first webinar. But to all the participants out there, so we've now got 740 participating with us, but just to introduce the webinar platform. So there's a chat box, which is your purple button, so if you want to have a chat, I presume that's about with yourselves. And if you have a question, please use the blue hand button and enter your question into the blue hand button. And please put your questions. I'll be monitoring the questions throughout the presentation today. The slides and resources are available from the light blue download button. And there's a help button if you need assistance so that you can message Redback directly, or you can ring them on 1800 733 416. Hang on a minute, I've jumped a slide. So the third slide. So what we're going to do tonight is we've got everybody giving, all the panellists giving a discipline-specific presentation, which we'll then be following by question and answers. We've already got up on the screen there for you the learning outcomes for tonight, so I'm not going to go through them tonight because I think what we've got to talk about, we want as much time as possible to talk about our case study. So if everybody's ready, I'll move through onto discussing with our first presenter tonight, and that's going to be Russell, who's got a lived experience of schizophrenia and an advocate. But I want you to just go back to it, think about the case study of Cynthia, who we'll be talking about tonight and relating our information back to Cynthia and her personal or particular situation. So Russell, over to you.
Thanks, Julianne. Thank you, everyone. Just some tokenistic things that have helped me along my journey that maybe in the context of Cynthia be useful for someone like her, but bear in mind that I'm just one off thousands or millions, so this is really the key things that have worked for me that I'm trying to, I guess, relay. So believing in myself or believing in something, be it the medication, which is was an imperative part of my medical team, doctors and family alike. It was important that I found a doctor that did believe in the medication rather than just prescribe it without any real knowledge or understanding of the implications of it and how to, I guess, fine-tune it and tweak it if the need arose. Sometimes, however, medication's not the be-all and end-all because, in my case, sometimes it overcompensates or undercompensates with the brain chemistry on the day. So having a backup philosophy or some sort of belief system in that you can attune yourself positively to, I found helped. And medication is a good recognised system and a staple, I guess, in terms of my recovery. So I really benefit from that belief in the medication, both from my doctors and my family. I'm not one to condone or condemn the church, but more so, I'll put it up there because it's a belief in something. And when you've got nothing else but hope, then I think belief in something is more tangible to subscribe to. So moving on to the next slide, I talk about accepting the illness and accepting that you have a condition. And although it's hard to get your head around that it's lifelong, you think as a consumer or as a participant myself, with experience, it's easy to think you're having a good day and you don't need the medication or that things are okay, they're going to be okay. But life cycles often throw you a curveball, throw everybody a curveball. So it's important to be able to see the forest through the trees and also know that things will get better if you do have a bad day or a bad couple of days, but also knowing on the flip side that not every day is a good day and knowing, you know, vice versa, that things can turn. Those ups and downs between the peaks and the troughs is where the insight is gained, I believe. I believe that is when you're outside of your comfort zone, the biggest learning opportunity for any individual. And for me, that is where the mentoring and coaching and the support that I got through those periods of time when I needed help wasn't when I was doing really well. It wasn't when I was at rock bottom and, you know, bedridden. It was when I was on the way up or on the way down that the support really garnered some strength and optimism in getting through the difficult times. And I guess accepting that you have an illness, accepting that it's not a weak... Well, I've prescribed it as a weakness, but it's not actually a weakness because of all the support around you. How lucky are we to have all the life coaches and the best people in the business, in the mental health field and others, industries, to want to help people like us to be better people. So if you can get on top of your illness early by doing the right thing, taking the medication and following the treatment plan, we can have a reasonable crack at having good quality life. So I believe those things are important. And as we get older, we want to help the younger people. So the support seems important, I think. Just moving on to the next slide, about the ups and downs, I note that any ship will nearly always self-right if tipped over. The cycles of life, the ebb and flow of the tide, we all know these metaphors and sayings. It's just helpful to know that things will come good again. It's a bit like rolling the dice eventually, and numbers, you know, you do get your numbers. Eventually the numbers come up, they come good. It's hard, but like right now, trying to present information that I'm not so confident in, but I know that at the end of the day, this webinar will really work out for people, and, you know, believing in what we're doing is helpful. So talking about favourite foods, there's sometimes moments in the schizophrenics or the person with schizophrenia's life where things aren't great, the chips are down. So having a favourite food or something to focus on as a reward or an incentive, even if you can't have it at the time, certainly a bit like the donkey and the carrot, I guess. It does incentivise you to reward, and it does certainly help to have something of a grounding, even if it's in your own mind. But that's obviously where, naturally, where a lot of problems come up. They can't always be discussed, can't always be easily spoken about. So having a little self-reward is helpful. And just one last notation about Christmas and family gatherings, which for the schizophrenic or person with schizophrenia, it's very, very hard often. Family gatherings with the pressure, the stress, the fitting in with the rest of the world and the family who know you, who knew you, it can be very confronting and very difficult for other reasons as well. So just finding it, keeping in mind a place where you want to, where the person wants to sit has always been helpful for me, just so you can fit in, but you can also have a get out if you need to. It doesn't matter who you necessarily are sitting with, but it helps ground the experience of gatherings or any other social activity where it's a little bit uncomfortable, a bit like the reward for cheese. It's a bit of a grounding technique that I've used and has really helped me along the way. Rewards are positive. They're not always constant, but life's problems and answers aren't always constant. So just having something to take the edge off, I find, through that grounding experience is really helpful. And I think that's me, and I think it's back to you, Julianne.
Well, Russell, look, thank you so much for everything you said there. As a clinician, your words have been really powerful, and I really thank you for your honesty. And I think there's an awful lot that we can use that we'll bring up in question and answer. So thank you so much, Russell. That was really excellent.
You're welcome.
And so we're over to Cathy now, and Cathy's going to talk about the diagnosis and etiology of schizophrenia. So over to you, Cathy.
Hi, everyone. Look, the first slide that I've got is just the DSM-5 diagnosis of schizophrenia. It really is there really as a revision. To make a diagnosis of schizophrenia, you need to have at least 1 month of symptoms from a group, including delusions, hallucinations, disorganised speech, disorganised behaviour or catatonic behaviour, and what we call negative symptoms, which are reduced emotional expression or lack of volition, reduced self-care perhaps, and impairment in one of the major areas of functioning for a significant period of time after, since the onset of the disturbance. And so often we'll see people who have had disturbance in their work, interpersonal relationships or in their own self-care. Overall, you have to have reduced functioning for at least 6 months. And it's important to differentiate that this person doesn't have schizoaffective disorder or bipolar or depressive disorder with psychotic features. However, diagnosis is very difficult, and often these diagnoses change over time, and it can be a lot more tricky than just applying a DSM-5 diagnosis. And just briefly, the etiology that we're looking at, there's so many causes of schizophrenia, it's not really understood that well as a disease. It's thought that genetics and environment both interplay, and the precipitating and predisposing factors will be very different for every individual. So it's very important to treat the individual, as I mentioned earlier, not the disease. People with the genetic risk, we usually find family history is one of the greatest predictors of risk. And if you have a first-degree relative with schizophrenia, you will have about a six-fold relative risk of developing the condition yourself, and this increases to a times 14 relative risk if you have two or more first-degree relatives, and 50% if your identical twin has schizophrenia. But as we know, that means that in most cases, probably having an identical twin, you're equally likely not to develop schizophrenia. And so environmental factors are hugely important. Past traumatic experiences are thought to be important. Perhaps some exposure in utero to infections or in early childhood may be also important in the development, but also things such as drug and alcohol, very important. Brain chemistry changes have been noted, but we really don't really understand those 100%, nowhere near 100%, if we know there's a relationship between schizophrenia risk and autism and OCD, for instance. But substance abuse is a very important differential diagnosis. Drug-induced psychosis in younger people can be very difficult to separate from schizophrenia, and it may be a prodrome of schizophrenia, or it may be just something related to drug use, but we certainly know that drug use can promote and precipitate schizophrenic episodes. So, moving on to my next slide, the common symptoms and challenges. Well, as I mentioned, diagnosis is often uncertain, and it's quite common for patients to receive multiple diagnoses, so often a provisional diagnosis, and the diagnosis can change over time. I've had plenty of patients who have been given diagnoses of schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder and personality disorder and drug-induced psychosis, and in the end, that's where it becomes very important to treat the person with what they need to be treated with at any particular time. There's no biological marker for schizophrenia. If you say, compare with heart disease, where we can do tests and say, yes, this person has this disease. In schizophrenia, it's usually a historical assessment. And so it really helps to know the patient or the client, the person. And over time, you may find that you need to modify your diagnosis or your impressions. So diagnostic uncertainty is very distressing for both for patients and for and is very stigmatising. And I think that that's what Russell was saying earlier, and the importance he noted of accepting your diagnosis. But I think that takes time, and I think a GP often is faced with the challenge of having to give a diagnosis that people don't want to hear, which is totally and completely understandable. So supporting a person through that just takes time, and we know that people with schizophrenia, especially in their early stages, have a lot of denial of their disease because they don't particularly see that there is anything wrong with them. GPs are often put into a double bind, which is often what was thought to be one of the etiological factors for schizophrenia in the past, because we must label patients in order to be able to prescribe medications and to start treatments, to do plans. So PBS and Medicare require that we have a diagnosis, but we have to sort of be able to remain sensitive to patients' needs and concerns about that stigma and about the medication. So in fact, the diagnosis is really for us as providers and for administrators. And so this is an important thing I find to explain to patients, that I'm not labelling them as a person, I'm labelling their illness at this moment, and because we need to label it in order to be able to manage it and treat it with the best things that we've got available in our society, in our community. Cynthia's a very typical patient, but there's no absolute, you know, or ideal or stereotype patient, really. Everybody expresses their illness very differently, and GPs are experts at individualised patient care, and so and understanding the person is the best way you'll get a good trusting relationship between a doctor and the patient, and having a regular GP gives you best outcomes. So there are studies that clearly show that the patients who have regular, reliable GPs and that they see on a regular basis have the best outcomes in schizophrenia and in most diseases and illnesses generally, actually. So for GPs, schizophrenia provides multiple challenges but also opportunities to help people with access evidence-based approaches that will help them to be most effective. Melissa mentioned earlier that she thinks it's important for us to promote psychological approaches and therapies in schizophrenia, and I totally agree. Older GPs were very much taught a biological model of disease, but we know that for at least the last 15 to 20 years, GPs have been trained, as they come through medical school and beyond, in a biopsychosocial approach. But as a GP, we have to manage the biological parts, which is the effects on the body, because there are high rate of comorbidities. We have to manage the treatments and medications. Socially, we need to manage isolation and social drift and poverty. So there are lots of challenges related to being financially disadvantaged, and obviously psychologically, there are lots of effects of schizophrenia in mood, thinking, relating skills, anxiety. So good engagement with the GP is on a regular basis is really important for avoiding the negative symptoms such as poor motivation, the withdrawal, isolation, also managing anxiety, the ambivalence, helping people accept themselves, managing the stigma, providing active follow-up and engaging the whole patient, is a whole of practice approach, really. So it's not just the GP, it's also the nurse, the practice nurse, other GPs in the practice, and also a multidisciplinary team to make sure that that person gets the best available care that is available for them locally. And GPs are often the case managers, usually the case managers, and sometimes the only person that the patient will trust. And if that's the case, well, we try to do all if we have to, but we do it best if we have support and we have lots of people involved in the patient's care. We as GPs recognise patients' triggers a lot of the time, so we get to know them and we can start to see early warning signs. We often know their context and their families, so this can be really helpful. And our aim is to go along, as Russell was saying earlier, to support them on their journey. So a familiar GP would be really helpful. So in the case of Cynthia, the loss of her regular GP would have been something that would have placed her at more risk in the last few years. And so, and as Melissa was talking earlier, I certainly concur with her, and people with schizophrenia absolutely definitely benefit from regular contact and counselling with SPS providers, and they're able to engage with all types of SPS modalities with a trusted therapy. But it's really important about picking the right therapist and the right treatment and in the right dose for any particular person at the right time. And it's important that we avoid making judgments about people and make allowances, though, at the same time for their negative symptoms, because there'll be times that they don't really feel like doing particularly much or engaging, so we have to be flexible and engage slowly and patiently. So thank you, Julianne.
Oh, wonderful, Cathy. That was a really great summary, so thank you. I think we'll have a few questions based on that in the Q&A. So now we've got Dr. Melissa Connell. So, Melissa, over to you.
Great, thank you. So, as I was saying before, there can be a lot of value to bringing psychological approaches to supporting a person with psychosis. So people do want to make sense of their experience, and helping them to develop self-understanding and build more effective coping strategies can have the benefits of reducing, I guess, the reliance on medications. While medications can be very important, being able to get by on lower doses can lead to improvements in quality of life and well-being. And as people develop better self-understanding and are able to manage difficulties that arise, hopefully that can also lead to a minimization of the need for hospital admissions. And of course, psychological approaches are always working within a recovery framework. So referral pathways to see a psychologist, many people come through Better Access, but unfortunately there's just 10 sessions a year, so that often means, meeting less frequently. Some people that have been lucky enough to get an NDIS package might be able to see a psychologist more often, but there's also private health options and both government and NGO mental health services. So for Cynthia, I think it's really important to get a good developmental history. I might do a timeline with Cynthia and look at some of the things that have happened in her life and how it's affected her, because we know she's had some significant adverse experiences. experiences that may be predisposing factors in her developing psychosis later in life. I'd be using a stress vulnerability model, and that could be very helpful as well with understanding the psychotic experiences that have emerged more recently for her. There are a variety of assessment tools that can be helpful. The SIRAPS, the Maastricht interview, which looks at voices, and the BPRS. So I'd be wanting to work together with Cynthia to develop a collaborative formulation where we can look at making sense of what's going on together. I'd be wanting to build a really strong relationship with her so that she can build trust with me. Sometimes people with psychosis have had negative experiences with prior mental health treatment, especially hospitalizations can be quite traumatic. So building trust and having a strong therapeutic alliance is really important. And I want to respect how Cynthia makes sense of her experience, and I want to be careful that I'm not imposing my interpretations onto her understandings. So I'd like us to both, to come up with a working hypothesis together. So I think to begin with, we'd really want to look at reducing her anxiety and distress, and we know that these are big precipitants of psychotic experiences. I'd be looking at building more adaptive coping skills for her to manage. Also, there's a potential that there's unprocessed grief associated with the loss of her father that may also be precipitating her difficulties. Improving mood, increasing her activities, and again, that recovery orientation. And I just want to point out that these are all very similar areas of difficulty that you'll find with other clients, you know, presenting for therapy to psychologists. And often psychologists think that treating somebody with psychosis might be beyond their scope, or that they don't have the experience or the expertise necessary to do that. But you'll find that people with psychosis have the same problems as everyone else. They struggle with loneliness, with depression, with feeling isolated and different from other people. So there's a lot that psychologists can do to support them. For those people that might want to do more focused work with voices and delusions, there are psychological approaches that have been found to be quite effective. ACT for psychosis, relating therapy for voices, compassion-focused therapy for psychosis, and CBT for psychosis. And when working with voices, the aim is to really look at the appraisal and interpretation of the voices and understanding the beliefs that Cynthia has about her voices, because often that's where the distress lies, and the distress is what fuels the struggle with voices. So you really want to be focusing on how she might change the relationship with voices, because sometimes it's difficult to get rid of voices, so how can you learn to live with them? And in relation to delusions, I'd be very careful, because these are experiences that Cynthia accepts as they're real to her. So I don't want to be invalidating or pathologizing of those experiences, but I want to focus more on just reducing the distress associated with them, helping her to feel safer and building up her engagement with other areas of her life. And it would only be over time, if she was showing curiosity, that we'd explore alternative explanations, and that might be more within a CBT framework. But that's something to do very tentatively. So over the longer term, we'd be looking at things that are going to help Cynthia improve her sense of self, how she might feel connected to others, finding meaning in her life, a sense of hope, opportunities for self-determination, and always consolidating those more adaptive resources for coping, and definitely linking her in with community supports. We'd want to understand her personal stress vulnerability factors, because that's very important in relapse prevention. Ongoing support for managing anxiety and voices would be important. She may like to participate in a hearing voices group. And it's worth exploring if there is any unresolved trauma associated with things like the bullying she experienced. And there are trauma-focused treatments such as EMDR that also have been found to be effective. So I'm hopeful that I would have a long-term relationship with Cynthia, and we could continue to work together in years to come. That's it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. That was really great, Melissa, and I think we're going to have a lot of good comments and fantastic questions coming through about all these presentations, so looking forward to that. That was excellent. So now we're moving over to Richard. So Richard, over to you with your presentation now.
So my experience has largely been in terms of having a long-term relationship with people, either in long-term psychotherapy, in assertive community treatment teams where the time period is kind of open-ended where we might work with somebody. So I went into this relationship with a sense that we're in this for the long haul, that we don't need to panic. And the first thing is to get to know each other and build some kind of shared understanding, and in particular attempting to understand the world as Cynthia experiences it, with curiosity, with humility, with respect, with openness, basic empathic listening, particularly for the untold story. As Melissa alluded to, often people come with a history of trauma. Often we come with our own assumptions about how things have arisen, and we should always be open to be corrected. Some people might see this as an assessment phase. I see assessment as a sort of a process rather than an outcome. It may involve doing some explicit kind of exploration around voices. It might involve something like open dialogue, which in itself is an intervention, and that people within the network get together with an openness to develop some shared understanding through dialogue. Whenever you get to know somebody, and this probably applies to people with a range of problems, I always find it useful to ensure that people go away from the get-go with something which is helpful to them. And it's always useful to normalise some of the extraordinary experiences that people that experience psychosis might have. Hearing voices are not that uncommon. Jumping to conclusions, having certainty about things that we later find out, that weren't founded, are really common experiences. So normalising that, sharing that can be really helpful. Exploring positive mental health, and using a framework such as PERMA, trying to find things that give positive emotion, that engage Cynthia, promoting kind of meaningful relationships, doing things that give a sense of accomplishment, purpose, physical activity, nutrition, sleep, and so on. I think the most significant and salient thing in Cynthia's story was that she's grieving. She's lost a really significant person in her life. That grief needs to be worked through and experienced as well. And it's okay. It's not a sign of pathology. So don't panic. And it's really useful to try and mobilise and extend any kind of supportive network. So Melissa alluded to the Hearing Voices Network, which is really helpful in overcoming a sense that people sometimes have that they're alone in these kind of experiences, that no other people experience just like them. And then we move on to a kind of working phase where Cynthia begins to actually identify with the nurse or other as a helping person. And here we might begin to explore a detailed developmental and trauma history, not as a moment in time, but building up this kind of this historical understanding of where Cynthia's come from. And here we really strengthen and mobilise what resources that we have. The coaching role is probably quite key. It's a good way, useful way to think about this. And we might coach with dealing with paranoia, intrusive thoughts. And this is where we can get some insights from cognitive behavioural therapy and other ways of working with psychosis. So things like the insight that having a thought does not make it a fact. And so changing this, the thought being a fact to I thought that, but I really know this can be helpful. And it's useful to have coaching around that, to play with that idea. And similarly, having a strong feeling doesn't mean something bad will happen. So I feel, but I really know that. And still in the working phase, assisting with coping with voices, this is a handout that I developed around some research around coping with voices about 20 years ago, and it's still relevant. This will be available as a link. Assists people in dealing with some of those beliefs about voices that can be problematic. That is that voices are all-knowing and all-powerful. So exerting some control over the voice-hearing experience, dealing with the intrusiveness of the experience, which can often cause distress. Here we might look at rationalising medication and really clarifying the expected effects of medication. Medication will not necessarily alleviate, all symptoms. In fact, it's very rare that that is the case. What is the role of medication and how can it be helpful? And here we begin to arrive at some kind of working formulation and we might begin to do some real goal setting about moving forward. In the exploitation working ending phase, Cynthia really begins to exploit the helping relationship that she has with the health professional to clarify what needs need to be fulfilled and have these needs met in the context of that relationship. And therapy at this time might become more formalised and negotiated as suggested by the formulation. So if there are residual traumatic experiences, then we may do some trauma-informed work. EMDR is, Melissa suggested, as one possibility. I like to consider the idea of advanced empathy as being a form of therapy in its own right. And that's really about not only just appraising, and communicating with accuracy how another person feels, but actually making a connection between how they feel and what's going on for them psychologically, or what's going on for them in their world. That's been written about by Jerry Egan recently, and again, there will be a link to some work that I've written around this notion of advanced empathy. Here we might also begin to really look at recovery planning. We may well be well into that, but the idea of relapse prevention, so, a wellness recovery action plan, who's going to do what, and when, and any referrals if needed.
Richard, thank you so much. And you brought up some fantastic points there, especially at the end about how to actually link all this up together, because a big part of tonight's webinar is that whole collaboration and how can we get the best outcome for people. Look, we've got some fantastic questions here that have been sent through. So I've got a couple though that I've thought of as well. But Russell, I wanted to just catch base with you a little bit if I may. Mm-hmm. You were talking a lot in metaphors and we had a bit of a chat before tonight about the role of metaphors and clinicians' work of using things like that and using your phrases. Like you talked about the waves and you can be very... You were mentioning too that some people with schizophrenia or other comorbidities can be very literal. Do you want to expand on that a little bit for me?
Just for mine, Speaking on the participants' terms is really helpful. So metaphors, if someone has a strong case of metaphors in their repertoire for talking, I think it's useful to engage with that. However, people with Asperger's are very literal. Mm. So if you said, let's go down the frog and let's hit the frog and toad, they'd probably go get a hammer and look for a frog and or a toad. But there are, in my case, I was brought up, my dad's a old school and a bit of a knockabout sort of in some ways, and some family members are. So we have a bit of fun with metaphors. So it works for me and I understand it. But I think for whatever makes sense, sometimes there's no easy way to sugarcoat things other than metaphors.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Russell. I think it's really important. So, and I like your differentiation between people with other conditions that might also sit alongside schizophrenia, like autism or Asperger's, that might be very literal. So it's very much that relates back to being very person-centred, isn't it? Understand the person. Now, Kathy, I've got a couple of questions here. There's quite a few, actually, from Ryan, particularly up about factors to promote or hinder engagement with GPs and how can we influence that relationship to be better. Do you want to comment about that a bit?
Thanks, Julianne. I think the main issue is to not rush the relationship, to build trust slowly. Understandably, patients with schizophrenia are quite weary of professionals. They've often had awful experiences in inpatient settings. So that I think we first of all have to understand that they're going to be perhaps anxious. In fact, likely to be anxious when they come to see a new GP. And so we should be understanding of that, trying to make that person as comfortable as possible. And to get to know them as a person, I think the most important thing we can do is to forget about the schizophrenia for a while, you know, and think, who is this person here, and what do they like doing? What's their everyday life like? Who do they live with? How do they manage their everyday life? I think once we get to know them as a person, we then find that they open up and give us a lot more information about the things that are distressing them, and therefore we've got more opportunities to be able to support them.
That's a really good point. Thanks, Kathy. We keep interrupting each other. Sorry about that. There's a couple of questions here also about working with adolescents. Melissa, perhaps you would like to address working with younger people. Do you take a different approach, or is there a slightly different presentation for adolescents? What's your feeling about that?
Working with younger people can be a really powerful time. So there are specialist services for early intervention for psychosis. You've probably heard of Origin in Melbourne and Pat McGorry. They've been real trailblazers in this area. So if we can intervene early and provide a lot of support and a lot of resources, there's the view, and there is some research that's showing it can help to avert that trajectory of a more persistent psychotic disorder. So working with adolescents it's definitely a big focus of treatment, and it is a bit different. You need to work a bit differently with adolescents and really try to understand what's going on for them. But it's quite traumatic when somebody has their first experience of psychosis as well. But trying to help them understand it, trying to avoid some of the stigma that comes with the diagnosis of schizophrenia. So we often hold off giving diagnoses such as schizophrenia, because they can be quite self-fulfilling. People can feel, you know, that their life is over when they hear that.
Gee, there's some really good points in there. So much media, isn't there, in some of the television episodes that portray schizophrenia in a fairly negative light can have a real detrimental effect, can't they? Mm. And I think just while I've got you there too, though, Melissa, if you could, and then I might go to Richard. But there's a couple of questions, one from Keith and Kathy, about the management of atypical transient psychosis without usual features of schizophrenia. Do you want to comment on that, Melissa? Just how do you actually work with that? And I think you just mentioned too that you hold back from a formal diagnosis of schizophrenia. So would this be in one of those instances, do you think?
Yeah, that's not a diagnosis I'm familiar with, but I'm assuming that's more of a brief psychotic episode. Yeah, and when we know that psychotic experiences are more common than we think, and there are people in the general population that when they're faced with significant stresses, their risk for experiencing psychosis can elevate, and it may not mean that they are going to develop a schizophrenia-type illness, but it's an understanding that they have a susceptibility in stresses such as, not sleeping, taking substances, interpersonal difficulties, whatever is going on for that person can put them over that threshold. And so these experiences can resolve quite well, and people can go on to manage that vulnerability but never have another psychotic episode in the future. That's just my understanding of what was, that question was asking. I don't know what you think, Richard or Kathy.
Yeah, so Richard, would you like to comment on that?
I prefer not to around the diagnostic issues. I think we can get lost in the diagnosis. But in terms of what we can all agree on is that, there's some psychotic symptoms can be very transient. Some psychotic type experiences can be very transient and under stress or when, intoxicated and so on. The experience that cluster of experiences, that involve, perceptual disturbance, thought disorder, delusions, and so on, can have a much more pressing kind of quality. People in the chat rooms have been, talking about people with a great deal of complexity that are pushing people away, that whose behaviour is driven by paranoid thoughts and ideas, and we can meet the person wherever they are. I think. It's our obligation to do so and to extend to them some helpful strategies to deal with the experience.
Thanks, Richard. I think that's a really good answer, and I think that being present with the person is absolutely critical, those the rapport building, isn't it? And that sense of knowing the person is so critical. So, Kathy, could I ask you, just staying on that atypical transient psychosis, so perhaps a third person's first experience of psychosis, is that something that you would see in a GP clinic that might, you might be sort of looking to collaborate more with some of the people around you? Could you comment a bit more on that too?
Yeah, early psychosis is really, really challenging. It's very much about getting a history from the family quite often rather than the person. The person themselves is often very reluctant to seek treatment. And so that's where it can be helpful to have already had a relationship with that person or with their family. We need to aim to treat the person, and so treat their symptoms, treat their functional incapacity, support them really, because I think that and avoid making diagnoses, especially for younger people, because a lot of these things, perhaps a lot of transient things, are drug-induced psychosis. Perhaps it's just an extreme form of anxiety. It could be a situational thing. So I think that we should try as much as possible not to get too caught up on the actual diagnosis as well. It's not particularly helpful for everybody all the time. So mostly we just want to think about what can we do to make this person feel and function better in their everyday life.
Actually, that leads me on to, there's a fantastic question here from Tom that was put up previously. And I'll just read it out as it goes. It says, is it time to put the term schizophrenia into a historical context? How far have we come with the terminology? And is this something we need to get rid of? So what's your feeling on that, Kathy?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's very much going to be something that's important to continue with from the very theoretical academic perspective, because we know that medication does help people a lot. It helps a lot of people a lot of the time, but many people with schizophrenia just use minimal amounts, so we are sort of stuck with diagnoses, unfortunately. But I think we need to take those with a grain of salt. The DSM is now a much, much bigger manual than the first DSM, so we should bear that in mind when we look at any diagnosis. And if anything, as people have already alluded to, have mentioned this evening, psychotic experience is a part of a continuum. Anybody under stress can experience a psychotic illness. People with a fever develop hallucinations just temporarily. So we have to be mindful of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You know, we accept that diagnoses are useful, but we also accept that we just have to manage people for who they are.
Can I also add something? Just the community.
Yeah, Russell, that'd be fabulous.
Just community education, similar to what Kathy's informed with, or seemingly, so it seems that she understands pretty well, from my perspective, from a consumer's perspective, is that we're just normal people. Just to have an illness, it's no different to diabetes or asthma. It's just a manageable illness. Yeah, it can be pretty ugly to start with, but, you know, I don't want to say anything too negative, but, you know, lots of things are ugly. Scabs are ugly, but, you know, big deal. You get on with it and then life gets better. Recovery is possible and is evident in a lot of people these days, more so than back in the 70s or the 60s or even early 80s. So recovery is possible. Life is an opportunity, and with the right support and the right group mindset from the community at large, we can, as consumers, live a pretty good life, or a reasonably good life, without the stigma, without the traumatic sort of experience that you get at work or from workmates or people that just don't understand. So education is really education, and for the self and for others, is really important to break down those barriers, I think.
Oh, Russell, gosh, you've put some great insights. I think we're all, it's so true, isn't it? That it's just learning how to live the best possible life you can, isn't it?
Yeah.
But while I've got you there, Russell, can I ask you, I mentioned this earlier to you, but, and there's a few questions I'm noticing on the questions here about diet. So there's one here particularly. Does poor diet have an effect on yourself and your experience? So, and what's your experience of the relationship between mood, behaviour, and food? So, would you like to comment a bit on that?
I can only try. Kathy's probably better versed than I am, but I'm happy to give it a crack. I love a meat pie or five as much as any other bloke in this country. But in saying that, I know what it does, and the effect on the brain chemistry and the body, this body's biological organic matter, whatever it is, the bloodstream, the carbohydrates, all those things can have an effect, just like medication can have an effect. Just like eating too much makes you too tired. There are obvious non-schizophrenic type decisions or problems associated with the wrong food or correct food. So some foods are really good, and nobody doesn't take an Einstein to know what, you know, fruit, veg, water, grains, meats, dairies, and all that is. Mine's cheese, mind you, but it's just a matter of looking after oneself as if you were the last, you know, like as if All right. So, Kathy, I think you're probably, I reckon you're better versed in dietary sort of things.
That's a really good segue, Russell. Thank you.
If I just add a brief comment then about diet, there's no doubt that psychotropic medication affects metabolism, and people do put on weight, and they do find it difficult to lose weight. However, I think that is only one of the determinants, and the other more important determinant that I see is actually social issues related, often because of poverty, financial distress, people can't afford to eat fresh fruit and vegetables, or they may be isolated, or they may, because of their negative symptoms, not feel like getting out of bed and cooking themselves a healthy meal or buying fruit and vegetables. So that's where I think psychological support and social support in a multidisciplinary sort of team allows people to learn how to cook. I have patients who have found cooking lessons extremely helpful and useful. Dietitians can be really helpful when they understand a person's context in how they can best support themselves and therefore develop the healthiest diet that they can.
Actually, great. Thank you for that, Kathy. That's really good. And I agree with you. Sometimes it is finances that actually hinder adherence to a good diet. It's just pretty expensive. A lot of people are on very low income, so that's definitely. But I think it's still, from a multidisciplinary perspective, really important to include a range of clinicians, i.e., you know, dietitians and whoever else is, you know, we can actually utilise to have that person realise the difference that they can make. Quite a few questions here about medication adherence. So one from Mari that says, could you cover strategies for medication adherence and coping strategies? So, Kathy, just having you back again, can you talk a little bit about medication adherence for us?
Well, medication adherence has always been one of the biggest challenges in people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia, because understandably, people don't necessarily believe that they have the condition or want to believe the condition, and may not have developed acceptance that Russell was talking about earlier yet for their condition. I think that's really critical. Once people can be gently supported to accept that they have that condition, and that may involve lots of counselling and lots of support, then they often can see the pattern that they do feel better and function better when they are on a particular dose of medication or are having particular supports in their life. So I think that, yeah, that's a very important part of get adherence. But we also know that that different medications have different effects on different people. So I think it's a conversation that patients should be having with their doctor or psychiatrist or the treatment team. Could I change to a different medication? Can my dose be lowered? What else can I do? I think there are options. I think often patients with schizophrenia aren't particularly assertive, so any sort of counselling that increases their assertiveness will help them to be able to talk about those things and so to increase their adherence and therefore decrease their side effects by minimising the doses, so we're not treating more than we need to treat, just enough. Or just good enough, really, for that person.
Yeah, fantastic, Kathy. That's great. And really important then to have that collaboration between providers too, isn't it? Which I think is important.
May I comment on that issue?
Yeah, just briefly, because I've got one more really important question that I want to ask Richard for. So go ahead, Russell.
I think it's really scrupulously important that we treat people with honesty, that we hold them in high regard. And we need to be really honest about the effects of medication with people. Australia has the dubious honour of having the most involuntary treatment of any country in the world. A recent study in Lancet Psychiatry of 22 countries, and we are double the median number and the highest in the world. Compelling people, coercing them, does not make them want to take medication. So we need to build good relationships with people. We need to be honest about the effects, and we need to inquire about the effects. So we need to say, what is this medication targeting? What can you expect? You know, what is the, you know, the minimum amount? If this is going to cause metabolic problems, people need to know. They need to know about, you know, that the potential risks associated with medication, and you know, really collaborate with the prescribers and those that care about them.
Can I also add?
Who's that?
Russell this time, the other Russell.
Yeah. Sorry about that mistake before. Yep.
The good-looking one.
You've got 1 minute, Russell.
Yeah, I only need 35 seconds.
Okay.
The medication adherence is difficult, but if you have some success and hit some runs early on, you're going to have more likely to have prolonged success with the medication regime.
Yeah.
So if you can make a big difference early on, which involves good psychological treatment and support, and the medication is sort of secondary but also just as important, I think you get better strike rate.
Russell, thank you for that. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. But look, I want to whiz back to Richard, if I can. Richard, we've got quite a few questions around hearing voices, and you mentioned that in your work there. So I've got some from Anita and quite a few other people here, just about our coping strategies for hearing voices. And then I've got something around, you know, how do you normalise hearing voices? Do you actually engage with people's voices? You have got 1 minute to talk about the impact of clinician engagement with voices. So can you do that?
I think there are a few kind of issues or kind of techniques or approaches. One I mentioned was open dialogue, which is a treatment approach that was developed in Finland and in Western Lapland. In response to what was called their needs-adapted approach to schizophrenia and psychosis. So that's where professionals and sometimes peers engage with the network in a humble way to try and build some sort of understanding about the problem. So we don't go in there with our diagnostic lens, you know, equipped with our bag of pills. We go in there when people are acutely unwell, and we try and collectively make sense of this experience. I don't have time to go into that. And then the other is the voice dialogue, which is where one actually construes the voice as having something useful to say, that, you know, the voice content is meaningful and says something meaningful about the person's experience. And then somebody dialogues with that voice. The individual themselves can actually go into dialogue with the voice, which are considered dissociated parts of the self. And so one can actually learn by engaging in a dialogue with the voice. Like, say, what do you want? What will it take for you to leave me alone if they're intrusive and so on? So again, that's another kind of technique, and people are wanting to explore that. You know, there are training opportunities and things around that. I would say join ISPS, the organisation Melissa alluded to or referred to. They have a book list, so they produce publications. There are many of them on these different approaches, as psychological and social approaches to psychosis.
So I'm gathering a lot of those will be up on the resources page, won't they, Richard? So, but look, what we have to do now, because we're going to run out of time very quickly, but I want to go back to everybody and just recap quickly. If you've got a pressing point or something you just would like to say, you've got about a minute each. So, Kathy, can we go back to you? Is there something you would like to just finish up with tonight as a parting message for everybody to remember?
I think the parting message I'd like to leave is that we should see people for who they are and develop relationships with them and be patient-centred. I support everything that everybody else on this panel said, and I'd like to leave everybody with the thought of our job is to really to offer people hope and to hold their hands and support them.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you, Kathy, and I just think they're beautiful words. Absolutely. Russell, what would you like to let everybody take away with them tonight?
Just that family and connectedness. Family connectedness, social and medical support is really imperative, and it does make a big difference. It might not seem so on certain days to the professionals, but you take that home with you and you think about what was said in an appointment or, you know, a week later you think what somebody said, and it can have a lasting impact. So the recovery is possible. It takes often some time for the penny to drop with certain advices and certain aspects, but the information is all together gathering and really important.
That's a really important point, you know, that recovery is possible. Thank you so much, Russell. I think that's brilliant. Melissa, have you got a lovely parting comment for people to take that they'll remember from tonight?
Yeah, I think we really want to respect people's right to determine their own experience. Mm. And we come in telling people they're delusional or what they're we're imposing our interpretations onto their experience. And in ISPS, we have a lot of people who are considered experts by experience, and they play an important role in educating mental health professionals about what really is valuable, and I think we really need to do more listening and less telling.
Really good point, Melissa. Thank you so much for making that. It's so important. Now, Richard, just a 1 minute. Have you got something that you would like people to take away?
I agree with everything everybody said. I think people listen to people, but also talk to them. I did some research about, 25 years ago around how people coped with voices, and the most surprising thing was people said, nobody's actually talked to me about this stuff before, and that people were really enthusiastic about sharing their experiences. Talk, listen, try and be humble and try and, develop a shared understanding with people.
Wonderful.
I think recovery, in every kind of recovery, whether it's personal recovery, functional recovery, is entirely possible and really where we should be aiming.
Do you have, and I want to go back to Cathy too, we've got a couple of minutes, so we're a little bit ahead by almost 1 minute. Just about collaboration, have any of you got something passionate to say about improving collaboration between all the players, the people the people living with schizophrenia, their families, the clinicians, the doctors? Is there anything any of you would like to add or comment about collaboration specifically?
Thanks, Julianne. I'd like to make the comment that the best way to call for us all to coordinate care and cooperate is to pick up the phone and talk to each other. That's the best way that we can discuss and help people and not to just sit as invisible people in invisible offices. Pick up and talk and involve the person as well with schizophrenia.
Can I add
that? That's a fantastic point, Cathy. Thank you for making that. It's so good.
I've got a point, Julianne. Russell,
yeah, go on,
again.
Russell.
The good-looking one. The good-looking one again.
His birthday is tomorrow. Yep.
Yeah, thank you. And my twin brothers. Just one point for me is that mental illness doesn't happen 9 to 5, Monday to Friday.
Ah.
As unfortunate it is for those that work office hours, for us, it's often a Friday night or a Monday morning or a Saturday night or Christmas parties or whatever. That's really difficult. So having preparation or mindfulness as to what those certain things look like and having the mindset of not the worst case scenario, but for the clinician to understand what the person what they're about to go through on a Friday night or a Saturday, because we go through more on a Friday night than most people go through in a month when we're really unwell. Yeah. And it's really taxing. So just bearing in mind that it's not an office job. It is a full-time job, but it's not an office job. So
Really good point, Russell. Look, thank you so much for making that point. And I think that's something we can all take away from tonight, is that it's not a 9-to-5 experience, so that we as clinicians and carers in the community must be very mindful of this from that person's experience. Look, our time's up, and I just want to thank absolutely everybody for contributing. I've learnt so much tonight. I think there's been a lot of information. Just flick the side over. And I just thank all of the participants, all the presenters tonight for giving of their time and their information. It's just been great, and I hope all the participants have learnt a lot as well. I do want you to complete the exit survey. You can see that up on your screen by clicking the yellow icon. Please do that before you leave tonight. And the next webinar will be Suicide Prevention and Safety Planning for the Veterans Community. This is going to be in partnership with Veterans Affairs on the 14th of November. And I think this is going to be a wonderful presentation. So if we can all consider joining in, that'd be great. And just a really important point to make here is that the Mental Health Practitioner Network supports the engagement and ongoing maintenance of practitioner networks where clinicians from different disciplines meet regularly with other mental health practitioners, share topics and resources, build local pathways and engage in CPD activities. So if you'd like to join your local practitioner network, please contact the Mental Health Practitioner Network here, or go to the news section of the website and indicate your interest in the exit surveys. And please, yeah, consider joining a network. I personally find them extremely valuable. And before I close, though, I'd really like to acknowledge the lived experience of people and carers who have lived with a mental illness in the past and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. And on behalf of everybody here, I'd really like to thank you and thank everybody for participating this evening. So thank you very much.